Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Double X is brought to you by Smith & Noble, offering custom window treatments, including blinds, shutters, shades, and panels, without the custom price. For a limited time, get 25% off your window coverings, plus a free in-home consultation when you visit smithandnoble.com/XX or call 1-800-659-3300. And by MeUndies. MeUndies makes the world's most comfortable underwear in a variety of styles and patterns. Head to MeUndies.com/XX to get free shipping and 20% off your first order. And by BowlAndBranch.com, offering luxury bedding at affordable prices. Order right now and they'll give you 20% off plus free shipping. Get sheets, towels, blankets, duvet covers and more at BowlAndBranch.com. That's BowlAndBranch.com and use the promo code XX.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, April 21st, the Spanx and Spanking edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. I'm joined in the New York studios by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah. Can I start the show with a mea culpa?
Oh my God, did we get email about they?
Whoa. Yes. So I completely screwed up in our discussion of they a couple weeks ago, and we got a lot of mail about it, and I just want to apologize. So I was very insistent, kind of oddly insistent, that when you use they as a gender neutral pronoun, that you say they is, because it's a singular person. Anyway, it turns out I was just wrong, and people say they are, which is a lot smoother on the ears. So I'm so sorry. And hopefully, I think we were talking about this, that we would like to return to the subject, you know, maybe expanding out from just grammar next time. but we think it's a rich one, and it's obviously one that our listeners are into. So sorry. And thank you, everyone, for writing in and clearing it up for us.
Weren't you impressed by, like, just the grammatical constructions people sent us and the examples and the long, I mean, we got so much email about that. It was impressive.
Yeah, it was totally impressive. Our listeners are really smart.
Okay, well, let's start the show. First, we're going to talk about sororities. Sororities are apparently not only thriving, but crawling with feminists, which was maybe a surprise. Our second topic, do a woman's domestic duties get in the way of creativity? And finally, we're going to talk about a new book called Sex with Shakespeare by Gillian Keenan about her obsession with spanking. Okay, let's start with feminists and sororities. There was an anthropology of the modern sorority in the New York Times, and apparently it is not your mother's sorority. It's full of feminists who say stuff like, thank you, sister, for passing along my resume. And they discuss toxic masculinity, and they have lean-in workshops. So the New York Times story about sororities opens on a spring break scene. Do you guys remember it?
Absolutely.
Spring
Bronze
break?
Girls.
Or the story.
No, I mean, just like the juxtaposition. It was like the visual that Jessica Bennett, who's the author, set of, you know, Bronze Girls, booze, and then somebody reading The Grounding of Modern Feminism. So that's the scene she's placing in your head of what sororities are like.
And also that the women from the sorority were almost using spring break in Cabo as an opportunity for consciousness raising.
Right. They were both participating in the scene and critiquing it, the patriarchal ways that had gotten them to there and their privilege that had gotten them to Cabo. It was kind of remarkable.
Yeah.
yeah.
Like I learned something, actually, because like the girls in high school, namely, you know, my daughter's age, are always telling me, like, they read Peggy Orenstein, whose book we discussed last week, Girls and Sex, also had scenes like this where she was talking to one of the young women about feminism as the girl was getting dressed to go out to a party. And the girl was like hiking up her miniskirt and putting on a tight shirt. And one of my daughter's friends read that scene and thought, like, yeah, so what? Like, how is that even a contradiction? What's the big deal? Of course, yes, I have both those thoughts. Like, I want to go to the party, and I also have feminist thoughts. So what's the problem? Is that what this article was teaching us?
Well, that's just sort of third wave feminism. To me, it's like the dual impulses of a 19-year-old are both that you want to be at the party, you want to have the fun, you want the attention from, you know, cute people of whatever gender you're into. But you also, there is no time in your life, probably when you're more into critical theory than between the ages of 18 and 22. And you love applying it to sort of all filters in your life. So to me, that was what was going on, possibly.
Interesting. So they were applying critical theory to the scene in Cabo. So it's like whatever a guy did. What was it? One of the guys did something interesting. They had to stage an intervention at some point.
It was a guy made to bite one of the sorority sisters. And
yes.
They were like, dude, what the hell are you thinking? Which, I mean, yeah, what else are you going to say? But it wasn't just that they prevented him from biting her, but also that they sort of asked him to question or interrogate his own toxic masculinity.
I wonder how open to it he was.
That was not addressed.
It was not.
Were you guys admiring?
Of the sorority sisters?
Just of the whole scene of like that way of being in the world where you are, I guess we would see it as having it always. They wouldn't see it that way. They would just say, okay, this is just life. I'm just living. I'm into critical theory and I like to party on the beach.
I guess that doesn't seem at all problematic. I can totally picture that. I guess the issue with the piece, which I enjoyed and I thought was very well written, was it was almost as if really unspoken and not from the author, but nevertheless, maybe in just the fact that it was even, you know, commissioned and published in the New York Times, was this feeling of, hey, you know, sorority sisters, we know those wahoos in state colleges might be a certain way, but hey, you know, at the Ivies or in New York City, they're totally feminist and smart. And maybe it was my wicked mind that, you know, connected those dots. But there was just this sort of feeling of sorority sisters, not what you think they are or not like you think they are. And that just felt, you know, even if it was inserted there by me and my, you know, bad way of thinking, that just felt a little bit, you know, unnecessary somehow. Or I don't know, that made me feel a little bit...
I completely inserted that thought, June, but more in questioning than in criticism. Mm-hmm. I just wasn't sure. I wonder if it's exactly the same shift is happening in state schools. I have no idea if any of our listeners are in sororities in state schools or their daughters are in sororities. I would be really curious if this article, which was in fact mostly about Ivy Leagues, sounded familiar, or if it just sounded like a privileged elite Ivy League landscape.
Yeah, I read a response in the Michigan Daily, and Michigan, you know, huge state school where a lot of smart kids go, you know, not that smart kids don't go to all state schools, but, you know, known as a place where people from out of state also go. And the Michigan Daily article was basically like, yeah, this is overlooking the vast majority of Greek life. The author had you know, reached out to people at UVA. And there's one quote I you know, thought was particularly relevant. A young woman who's in Alpha Phi at UVA said, while Greek life supposedly promotes a space for women to interact, it imposes rules on them that aren't imposed on the men in the university, which, she said, allows men to completely dominate the social scene, giving women reason to want to objectify themselves in order to get to parties and fit in socially, which to me is like the Greek system. The sororities are intertwined with frats, and frats at most schools are the ones who have the houses where you can have alcohol, and they throw the parties, and they impose these totally retrograde, like, looks tests, mm-hmm. and, you know, all kind of ways to, like, let women in or not let women into these parties. But the thing about this piece, my, like, editor's eye was mm-hmm. like, okay, I might have headlined it differently, which might have been, you know, obviously feminism is kind of a grabby headline, but actually, to me, the interesting thing in the piece is that sorority enrollment at Ivy League specifically is way up. So at Brown, which is like the most, you know, alternative of all the Ivies, this year there was a 42% increase over last year in sorority rushing. And that's, you know, similar numbers at Harvard, at Yale, at Columbia, where the piece was located. And to me, that was what was interesting, was that there are these hothouse schools where people come in, and all of a sudden, in a way they weren't 10 years ago, they're wanting to be part of this specific social scene.
Why was that? That I didn't exactly get the increase. Like, mm-hmm. what? It's either feminist in the sense they want to be in a sorority. And I went to Stanford where there were sororities, and they were super lean in. Like, it was all like, we're going to do good works and we're going to network. I mean, it wasn't only that, but that was certainly a strain of sorority life. So there is a kind of elite school networking thing that mm-hmm. gets formed, but you wonder if it's something else too, I want a party among women.
Of the things that was unspoken, and maybe just because everybody just accepts it and sees it in the numbers. But so when they mentioned that at Harvard, where they said a lot of students who go to Harvard don't even realize that there is Greek life there, that sorority enrollment has peaked, and last year, 280 women sought entrance into sororities and 193 were offered bids, which means that like more than a third didn't get in. And that to me is, you know, that not only are we talking about these very elite schools, but also that they're very, that the sororities themselves are exclusive. And I realize that's because partly it's a place where you live. So you're also kind of applying for a home. And maybe they are particularly attractive places to, you know, spend the night or whatever, you know, to maybe they have nicer rooms than the dorms or whatever the thing is. But that rubs me the wrong way. Why are you being so, you know, I don't know, of course, why women were excluded or didn't get in. Maybe they weren't applying seriously. Maybe that whatever it was. But that, I don't know. That to me is the most negative aspect of all of this.
Well, my God, Noon, you are so idealistic. or else June is like working out a wound. Like I'm trying to imagine June at the line of Kappa Alpha Theta.
Jezebel published recently a leaked email from USC Rush that kind of tells you, at least at USC, exactly, why people might not make it in. So they gave the women who wanted to be in the sorority a number of requirements. One was Spanx. The email goes, "I cannot stress how important Spanx are to make you look your best. Even if you are very thin, Spanx will give you a better line when you wear clothes." And then it went on, you know, "You cannot have, you know, roots in your hair. You better get your highlights updated.
You better get your eyebrow game on point.
Full eyebrows are in style right now, but full does not mean bushy or wild." I mean, it goes on and on and on.
Wait a minute. 19-year-olds wear Spanx?
Yeah, isn't that insane?
Why would you start so early? That's terrible.
I don't know. I don't think Spanx had been invented when I was 19, but it was to
Thank
say
God
what
for
I
you. Have either of you ever had a personal encounter with sororities? Like, you know, been to a party at a sorority, had a really good friend in a sorority?
My experience of all college life is via television. So I'm very familiar with them from like Scream Queens, or there was a recent storyline in The Middle. So I know all about sororities, but not by anybody I actually know in real life.
Yeah, my school didn't have sororities, which I loved and was actually a reason why I chose it in part. But, you know, some of my high school friends and friends since were in sororities. And so I like vaguely absorbed certain things. Like I've absorbed some sexist like language around it. Like, I know if you can't get laid, try dealt, you know, but don't really know that much about them personally. So I like June, I actually have this very stereotypical vision of them from pop culture, from sort of the most scandalous things my friends told me in the mid-aughts, from just like my own biases against, you know, like a certain kind of partying and a certain kind of culture. Yeah. I will admit that I'm probably super prejudiced against sororities as like a baseline thing.
It's interesting to me that this, I mean, we all know that stereotype, that this story was sort of sub rasa critiquing or trying to set something, you know, an alternative up against that. That's how I see it, you know, that there's surely that stereotype is slightly unfair. Like, surely it exists, but surely there are other reasons to join a sorority, and there are other things that you get from them other than, you know, almost guaranteed entrance into the frat parties. But, and this is another kind of sorority. This is another image of sorority life that, you know, I don't doubt those women's truth. I'm sure that, you know, those sorority women at Columbia and all the other ones that we met in this story, that they really are there for the, you know, feminist theory.
Mm-hmm.
That's an alternative and that's fine. But I don't believe that either are the whole story, which doesn't seem like such a profound insight, but.
Yeah, it's about, I think it genuinely for a lot of people is about close female friendships on within a structure, right? Like, I was thinking, this is a little bit of a tangent, but last time I recommended the Richard Linklater movie, which is all about college boys and how fun it is to be a college boy. And I was trying to game out for myself, like, what would that look like if you did a version with college girls instead? Like, it would probably be at a sorority. Would it just have this sense of light fun, or would it be sort of charged in a way, you know? And I don't know. I want people who are in sororities to write in and tell me, like, what would your Richard Linklater, like, you know, college, beautiful, just like, you know, Vaseline on the lens memory be of sororities?
Well, maybe that's the pop culture stereotype, is that they're mean and bitchy, mm-hmm. like those letters that always leak in Jezebel, when the truth right. is it's fun.
Right.
You know, like the one awesome thing in that story was that there was a Dartmouth sorority that gave up funding so they could hold their own alcohol party.
Yeah.
That seemed awesome.
I agree. And not only because, like, I know that alcohol is so complicated on American campuses because of the 21 to drink thing, but that whole, you know, the idea of there being this establishment, this sorority establishment, who are older and, you know, maybe more traditional, and who are setting the rules that your chapter or your house has to follow in a certain way. That felt like the biggest tension point in this story. It wasn't between big state schools, who really weren't mentioned. It was between these new feminist sorority women and the kind of the bosses of their sororities at the Panhellenic Council. Mm-hmm. And the idea of, you know, separating from the establishment and starting your own, it doesn't seem like it feels like limited. Like when you graduate, does it stop? You know, don't you just set up your new establishment? But that really did seem like a great solution to the negative things that we're all so familiar with, maybe from real life, maybe from not.
And also a great sequel to Animal House, the feminist Animal House, which is, you know,
like, oh, yeah,
kind of right
like
there.
Ghostbusters.
Yeah,
call me, call your agent.
Get at me, Hollywood.
Okay, let's end on that note. Listeners, if you have stories to share about sororities, please do educate us. Tell us what sororities are like now, what they were like then, and why you joined one. You can do that on our Facebook page or send us an email. We'll leave the addresses at the end of the show. Okay, let's move on to our next topic, which is women's work and creativity. But before we do that, let's hear from our first sponsor.
The XX GabFest is sponsored this week by Smith & Noble. So I live in a small Brooklyn apartment, which I love dearly. You know, the proportion of the space is such that my curtains make such a difference, right? And I just made the wrong choice on my curtains. They are blue and they keep out the light and I hate them. And every time I look at them, I get a little bit depressed. And I made that mistake because I don't know what I'm doing when it comes to interior designing. And I can kind of look at a couch and say, okay, I know what couch I don't like. I know what couch I like. I know the basic space. But to me, window treatments are like the secret sauce of it, of decorating. It's one of those things that I feel like people who know really know. And it's one of those subtle differences. It's like having the exact right shape of eyebrows on your face or something. And, you know, plucking yourself, if you're really good at it, you can do it. But if you make a mistake, you really make a mistake, as me and my blue burlap curtains and overplucked eyebrows can tell you. So there is an answer to this, and that is Smith & Noble. And what Smith & Noble does that's different than just kind of going onto the Pottery Barn website and being like, I don't know, that one looks like it'll fit my room. Instead, you work one-on-one with an expert designer, and they'll even come to your home and kind of look around and take measurements. And they will even come, once you've picked out what you want, they'll even come and for a low cost, they'll install it personally. So you not only get a perfect fit aesthetically, you get, you know, an actual perfect fit physically on your windows. So Smith & Noble has a special offer for XX listeners. If you go to smithandnoble.com and enter the promo code XX, you'll get 25% off on your window treatments, plus that free design consultation, which in my next apartment, I really think I might take advantage of. So you can also call them at 1-800-659-3300 for this great deal. Again, that's smithandnoble.com/XX or 1-800-659-3300 for 25% off window treatments and a free design consultation.
Okay, on to our second topic, women's work and creativity. A topic of eternal interest to women. This time, it was launched by an article in The Cut called Is Domestic Life the Enemy of Creative Work by Kim Brooks. That article talked mostly about children, but I would like to broaden it to talk more generally about the caretaking obligations placed on women, whether it's taking care of kids, being a good hostess, keeping the house clean, whether they rob women of their creative juices and time. So, or put another way, are women considered selfish if they put their creativity before anything else? All right, ladies, did you, when, sorry, women. All right, women.
With a Y.
With a Y. Women. When you read this story, were you like, ah, that's not me, that's just people with children? Like, do you actually feel that this is a conversation that people, women with children, obsessively have that is not relevant to you? Or do you understand what they're talking about, that there are different domestic obligations placed on you that make it difficult or selfish for you to be purely creative?
I think it does. Children do make a difference. And I think that's obvious. Like, there's a thing called child protective services. There isn't marriage protective services. There isn't, you know, homosexual relationship protective services. We have rules and regulations of how parents particularly and how society generally, how much attention and how much care we give children. So it is different. And it was really interesting. There was a I can't say who said what because I didn't ask their permission, but there was a really interesting discussion, you know, among the Slatesters from men and women, parents, about this piece. Some of who, I think, in fact, all the people I'm thinking of have written books. So they're people who are extremely productive, extremely disciplined. And, you know, they all said that, yeah, two things. First, that the responsibilities of parenthood demand a particular kind of energy, they do demand time, and that they kind of drain you of the special sauce that, you know, helps, especially when it comes to writing. On the other hand, some other people said, yes, but parenthood is also extraordinarily compatible with writing as a job that pays you money, because you can do it in your pajamas, you can do it at odd times, you can do it when the kids are sleeping, you can, you know, go over edits with a baby on your lap. So that there were those two points of view. So it does seem different from when you have children. Things are you know, the stakes are higher. But I do just generally think that life and work and yeah, creativity is not, you know, having a 9-to-5 job is difficult to combine with parenthood or domestic life. But there is something different too about creative work.
I think that kids are a very, very different scenario, and I want to talk about that in a minute. But just I do think there is something where I spend time on things that are, you know, obviously not kids, but, you know, I putter around the house. I go and like get my bangs trimmed. I do all these things that are probably tied to my gender that might take time away from creative work. And I feel like I can't escape them. I very easily could, but it's a lot easier for, I think, for whatever reasons, mostly internal reasons, for a man to walk around with like shaggy hair and never clean the bathroom. And I know men who are writers who are like this and who are totally selfish about that. And I think that at least for people who don't have kids, that sort of pressure, not even pressure, just the like the way you segment your time, that's internal pressure mostly. But it's there. But on the question of, you know, whether creativity is totally stifled by having kids, to me, all of this, like all of this discussion that we are all constantly having about how your life changes when you have kids is kind of terrifying. It's like the current discussion around having kids is basically like your selfhood is sort of immolated when you have kids. And maybe that's just because, you know, people only write about the aspects that are sort of most different and what changes. But for those of us who are sort of on the other side, I don't know. It's really discouraging. And I don't know if it's because the internet. I'm serious. Like,
I know, but I feel so the need to jump in. Like,
so
I
jump
can't contain
in. Tell
myself.
Me. Tell
okay.
Me.
Do you notice the age of the children of the people
they're
who
young.
Write about
they're
these
young.
Things? Yeah. Does anybody write about this thing who has kids who are like 10 or 11? No, because it's just like at first it's kind of a shock. And like, you're right. People don't write about how fun it is to have kids. Like, it's just unbelievably fun. Children are fun. They don't think like other people. So they, you know, they it works. All sorts of ways in terms of its relationship to your creativity, because children say crazy things and they introduce you to worlds that you didn't see before, and paces and rhythms and ways of being and kind of a consciousness that gets like dramatically slowed down. Like the Jenny Offel book Department of Speculation was mentioned because there's also a thinking that people are starting to write about this different consciousness and psychic space that people enter into with children, and that becomes a source of creativity. Like, there's a lot that children do besides, you know, suck up your time. They really, honestly, they're just, it's not like a medical condition where you have to go get your dialysis and it's just so much freaking time. Like, that's not all that it is, you know?
I know.
It just pains me that, like, young people without children read all this stuff and think, like, oh my God, that sounds awful.
Well, it is. It's just everywhere. And perhaps it's just the corners of the internet I inhabit, or it's my age or whatever it is. I just find it like, I don't know. It's all these people, you know, I can't tell if they're trying to warn me off or to sort of say, like, look how strong I am. But it's really like, it's just a thing that's happening. And to me, this piece, like, okay, whatever, like writing novels is clearly Kim Brooks is coming from a place of privilege, right? It doesn't sound like she's worried about making rent with her writing, which in some ways probably makes it harder to do your writing as a parent if you're not actually bringing home like a steady paycheck for it. You can't be like, okay, let's clear the space for this. She, you know, she's working on the self-actualization part of the question. But, you know, I want to be a self-actualized person. I think everyone wants to be a self-actualized person. And so the lessons that you take away from this is that it's not just that yourself changes, it's that yourself becomes less important than all these other beings. And I think that probably is the idea of parenthood and of love of that kind. but someone should just do a better job of selling it, really. Like, hire an ad, you know, like, I think Parenthood in America needs a good ad campaign right now.
I think it's urban thing, too. Like, do you think where you grew up, people have this sense? Like, I think it does have to do with how many hours urban people work. Like, it's not just a creativity thing, because after all, you know, your children are in school a good chunk of the day. And then, you know, one, if one can afford it, has babysitters. And so, like, I work 9 to 6 the same way anybody without children works from 9 to 6. And that's true even if you have little children. I know there's something more profound than what I'm saying. It's not just about time. It's about this little being who needs you constantly and eternally. I guess for me, what I'm interested in is the ambivalence of desire around this. Like, how much, you know, how much of this is social expectation of women, like you mentioned, Noreen, which has for women with children and without children about a certain way you're supposed to be in the world, and how much of it is my own internal desire. And I have a really hard time distinguishing between those two, you know. Can I just share with you guys like a personal conversation that happened between me and David recently?
Please do. Please
like,
do.
Okay, I've got a husband who's super supportive. I've had a job who's really flexible. But here my husband takes a job which requires him to be in New York 3 days a week. And I'm thinking to myself, like, patriarchy, like, why does he get to go to New York? And he's like, and then David says to me, like, look, if you got a job where you like really wanted to do this job and it required you to be in Philadelphia 3 days a week, you know, I wouldn't say no. You know, I'd be happy for you.
But you aren't looking for jobs in Philadelphia.
Well, that's the problem, because I don't want to, and I never would want to be away from my children 3 days of every work week. So who's, is that, what, why? Is that a social expectation because other people would judge me, or is that my own genuine internal desire? I kind of, as I get older, think it's, the answer is number two, and I don't really know what to do with that, you know? It's confusing.
I don't think there's anything wrong with not wanting to commute to Philadelphia 3 times a week. I think that would just make
it
all
New York,
so much.
Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Or, well, okay, change of mind.
No, I mean, like, spending all that time on the train, I mean, you just would siphon away from your life in all kinds of ways.
No, but I'm talking about, like, not, I would not ever choose to be away from my children 3 days a week because I don't want to. I do not want to do
that. Why should you have to apologize for that?
And I don't, but it's complicated. It's like in these creative things, it always seems like something imposed on women. And I think at some level, it is imposed on women. Like, there would be social judgment if you decided to take a job that would put you away from your children half of every week. There definitely would be social judgment, but also there's internal desire, and I don't want to do it. And that's confusing, because who's to blame for that?
Well,
like, what structures am I going to undo to make that not true?
Well, I think that there's another aspect to this story, to the story in the cut, that is kind of relevant to the kind of tension you're talking about, Hannah, which is that it's about creative work. It's not about, you know, going to the office or working retail. It's about creative work because, again, that is something that people feel really drawn to. They feel, you know, it's something in them that they feel they can't deny. They really want to do it to, you know, express themselves, to express their talent, whatever. But it really doesn't pay unless you're extraordinarily successful. And so, you know, if you were going to Philadelphia for a job that paid money, that would be very different from, I am not spending time with my children because I'm trying to do something very selfish, I think it's seen as, that really won't bring us in any cash or help our family. In fact, it will cost us money because, you know, we're paying for childcare for this. So that's a slightly different scenario, but I think it's the same thing of, I am neglecting my children, which clearly is a very exaggerated point of view, for this thing which feels selfish. And I think people know that it kind of is selfish, and that actually is okay. But I think a lot of these stories are actually about people kind of working through that and talking themselves through something that they internally feel bad about while at the same time feeling good enough about it to do it. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. I mean, the gender divide on selfishness, I think, is powerful. Like, yeah. I've had a number of women friends who are artists, particularly, who find it, you know, who are my age and who are artists, who find it very difficult to justify, you know, you could spend a year, you know, like, we write for money, or in my case, radio for money. Like, but let's say you're an artist, right? And so you could go a year and just like, it's not totally gelling what your vision is for that moment. Mm-hmm. And so try as a woman to justify that time in your studio or away from your family. It is much harder for women to get away with that than it is for men.
Yeah. Another thing that Kim Brooks wrote about in this piece that I thought was interesting, was she said, to try to make art, you're trying to in some way destabilize the world.
Right.
And the reason that you have a family and love being part of a family is because it imposes this, you know, enveloping kind of order on the world, this stability. And those things are kind of in opposition to each other. And I was recently reading the third Elena Ferrante book, and this is basically a total, like, she writes about this in this way, yeah. Spoiler alert, after she has kids, she's not able to write in the same way. And then she does write something and it's just not good. And this is all over literature. Laura Miller wrote a piece about how this kind of genre of women who are sort of unhappily suppressed in their creativity after becoming mothers is all over the current literature. It's a total trope. But yeah, I just thought that Kim Brooks' insight that stability and art might simply be at odds with one another was a good one. On the other hand, you can point to millions of examples of artists and writers who have happy home lives, mm-hmm. Not only men, women too. So,
you know, Dorian, just to not make you depressed about that particular mm-hmm. point, I think that's a profound point, but I also think it's very strongly, shockingly true of young children, where suddenly when you have babies, you're like thrust into this world of schedules mm-hmm. And a clock that like an internal clock that hadn't been there before. And it's for practical reasons like nap, this, it's because you're desperately trying to sort of not have your world turned upside down and be up all night. Like, there's a lot of reasons why suddenly you're on a schedule because you have to be home for dinner. And that is a little dulling to the chaotic force. That is true.
But, you know, I'm sensing something here, too, in your, like, maybe protesting too much, Hannah, which is that, yeah, at first, when they're young, that is very striking because it's the first time you're exposed to it and you have to get on a schedule. But that schedule continues until they learn to drive or whatever. I mean, you still take your kids to school. You still have to think, oh, they've got, this one's got music practice. This one's got...
Yeah.
I think you just get used to it. And yeah, that makes it easier. But it is something that is now just part of your life. It doesn't maybe pull so much or demand so much because it's just kind of, you've just gotten used to it. But it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
No, it's not just work. I do yearn for like uncertainty, like a day that can unfold in a way which I can't predict. And that only happens when I'm reporting, when I'm away on a reporting trip or something like that. Like then I never know what's going to happen one minute to the next. But it's true. It does not happen when I'm home. All right. Enough about me, Noreen. So what do you say? Did we anything? Did the world of motherhood look any more, like even one degree more appealing than it did before we started this conversation or less appealing?
More appealing. It was nice to hear a defense. And I also spent the weekend with my sister and her toddler. And everything that you just said about a schedule is so incredibly true. But also the joy that she gets from her daughter and the transfer joy that I got. So there is something that it's hard to put into words that I think parents get. So I'm envious of that.
That was sweet. We'll end there. All right, let's move on to our final topic, Sex with Shakespeare, a new book by Gillian Keenan. But before we do, we want to hear from our next sponsor.
This week, the XX Gabfest is also sponsored by MeUndies. Now, underwear is one of those things that is invisible to the rest of the world, but it's really, really present to you because if you have some uncomfortable underwear, it can ruin your day. MeUndies is here to change that. Every pair of MeUndies is made from sustainably sourced modal, a fabric that's twice as soft as cotton. Once you put them on, you'll understand why they're called the world's most comfortable underwear. And if you don't love your first pair of MeUndies, they're free, no questions asked. MeUndies has dozens of styles and limited edition prints to help you make a statement with your underwear, whether anyone can see them or not. And if you have a subscription to MeUndies, you do get their special limited editions. Just last week, I received their new wildflower pattern, which is this really cool inky blue color and has very nice wildflowers on it. And it just reminds me of spring and puts me in the right frame of mind. Shipping is free in the US and Canada, and you can save up to $8 a pair with the MeUndies subscription plan. Get the subscription or a single pair and get 20% off your first order when you go to MeUndies.com/XX. That's MeUndies.com/XX, DOUBLEX, for 20% off your first order. MeUndies.com/XX.
All right, let's move on to our next topic, Sex with Shakespeare. Sex with Shakespeare is a new book by writer Gillian Keenan. It's her memoir about being what she calls a sexual masochist and how reading Shakespeare helped her come to terms with that. God, it's like really funny to say all this stuff in a straight voice, but what can you do? Like, we're talking about it out loud. Hi, Gillian. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Hannah. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So I'm going to start slowly to like ease people into the book because people don't, you know, associate these two subjects together, like sexual masochists, Shakespeare. Like, we're going to walk people through a little bit basics about the book. So you start by describing yourself, even as a child, as obsessed with spanking, and you emphasize the word obsessed because I think you really want us to understand that. So just tell us about that. What does that mean?
I think that one of the most common misconceptions about the BDSM spectrum is that it's something that adults discover later in life, or that it's a preference, or that it is a side dish to more normative forms of sexuality. When in my experience and in the experience of huge numbers of my friends, people who share my identity, that's absolutely not the case. Even from my earliest memories, I can look back and pinpoint things I did as a very small child, as a toddler even, and say, yep, those were early manifestations of my identity. Like any other sexual identity, it's not something that just magically appears at 18. My masochism and my fetish were always there.
Well, and, you know, Shakespeare's in the title of the book. You also were obsessed with Shakespeare.
I can't claim to have been born obsessed with Shakespeare. That did come later in life, around age 15.
But you do have your sort of your discovery moment, your origin story of your both of your connection with Shakespeare, but then the sort of what the book ends up in a way being about, which is how Shakespeare and how scenes from Shakespeare and characters from Shakespeare helped you figure things out. So can you kind of talk us or explain to people who haven't yet read the book kind of how you approach that and how that kind of became clear to you that that was what you needed to do?
Definitely. I fell in love with Shakespeare when I was 15 years old. I saw a production of The Tempest at the Utah Shakespeare Festival in Cedar City, and a man named David Ivers played Caliban that day. His performance was extraordinary, and from that moment on, I was absolutely hooked. And it makes sense that Caliban was the first character that pulled me in to Shakespeare. As I said, my sexuality and my fetish were already there. And The Tempest, and particularly the character of Caliban, deal in fascinating ways with these questions of power and powerlessness, which of course are things that play into my fetish. So it makes sense to me that I was so drawn to Caliban. But the moment when I first connected my interest in Shakespeare with my fetish was a moment when I reconsidered one of my favorite plays and one of my favorite characters for the millionth time. And it occurred to me for the first time that maybe Shakespeare had included a character like me in his world. And everyone agrees that Shakespeare was such a remarkable chronicler of the human condition. And so just the possibility that Shakespeare had included someone like me in his natural world made me consider for the first time that maybe I was human too. Maybe I wasn't the disturbed, broken, damaged monster that I had always thought I was.
And that character was Caliban or someone else?
That character was someone else, but I don't want to give it away.
Ah.
But I'll say this. In the book, I like to joke that I out one of Shakespeare's characters as a masochist. Based on close readings in the text, I don't just make this leap out of nowhere. But when I really dig into the language of one of the plays, I think that there's a character to be outed as a bit like me.
Well, I have to say, I was very convinced by your close reading of that character who will remain nameless in a play that will also remain nameless. But that it does bring up something that's very key to the book that I think it leads me to a question, which maybe is not for an author to consider, much less answer. But, you know, as I was reading it, I thought, well, OK, so people who come to this wanting to know more about spanking and about, you know, sexuality and sexual identity will, you know, they will get something out of this book. People who are really interested in Shakespeare and close reading of Shakespeare will get something out of this book. But are they the same person? And when you were writing it and these things which are very important to you and have been really crucial to your development as a person, it makes sense that you would connect them in this way. But can you kind of predict how, or do you have any sense of how Shakespeare fans will you know, people who really want to get your intense Shakespeare reading will respond to the book.
I do think that both sides of this story will be interested or interesting to people who approach the book from either perspective, either from the perspective of an interest in sexuality or spanking, and people who approach the book from an interest in Shakespeare. Because I think people who are interested in Shakespeare are also interested in how Shakespeare interacts with our lives, how Shakespeare informs our development and our understanding of ourselves. And certainly, from that perspective, they would be interested in how Shakespeare informed my understanding and ultimately acceptance of my sexuality. I think that people who approach the book from an interest in sexuality are interested in how people with non-normative identities come to accept and embrace that. And in that case, I came to accept and embrace my fetish through Shakespeare. So I think that both sides will be interesting to everyone.
You know, Jillian, I was reading this and it struck me, it's very much like a coming out memoir, you know, in the beats that it has. Like, you start with a sense of loneliness, you know, like you're guarding a secret, you're the only person in the world. And then you are the kind of the things, the moments that stuck out most with me are the moments when generally a boyfriend recognizes it in you and you're kind of amazed. You know, it's as if like, oh, somebody sees your secret. Is it written all over me? And then also when you recognize yourself in literary characters, it's like it goes from loneliness to recognition in a way that is, you know, that coming out memoirs used to and probably won't anymore. Is that how you experienced it?
Well, I certainly for a long time, and I know that I am not unique in this, really thought it was just me. I thought that everyone else was fantasizing about sex and looking at sex-related internet searches and getting excited when they saw sex in movies and TV shows. And I couldn't have cared less about sex. When I saw sex in movies, I had no response. When people talked about sex, I had no reaction. I had zero desire to ever Google sex-related search terminologies. I responded to spanking scenes in movies and TV shows. I responded to references to spanking. I secretly did internet browser searches for spanking-related words and terms. And I thought that this just meant I was really fucked up, that something was deeply wrong with me, and that everyone else was healthy and fine, but I was just this pervert who needed to be cured. So it was really remarkable and such a relief when I started to realize that not only was I not the only one, but that there was nothing messed up about me and that it was just another healthy and natural point on the sexual spectrum.
There's a scene, Jillian, in the book, which is very powerful, where you and your partner become very concerned that someone has seen him spanking you and will report you to the police or report him to the police as a scene of violence. And I think I see that from both sides, because there is, you know, a point of view that violence is violence, no matter how, you know, devoutly wished it is. So can you explain how you worked through that? Because I know that was something that also was in your mind.
Sure, that was a weird day for both of us. And as I write in the book, there was an initial moment of relief. When we realized we were being seen, we kind of panicked. And there was this moment of about half an hour where we kind of sat there waiting to see if the police would show up. And then there was an initial moment of relief. But then after the dust settled and I started to think about it, I realized, no, that's horrible. This woman should have called the police because she had just seen us through through two windows and a courtyard. It was the construction of this apartment building was strange. But she had no idea what she was looking at. And she had no reason to suspect that she was witnessing something consensual. As far as she could have known, she was witnessing domestic violence and therefore should have called the police. And the fact that she didn't dismayed me and bummed me out, particularly because at the time, my then boyfriend and I were living in a country that had a serious domestic violence problem. And for the first time, you know, I had spent a few years at that point trying to convince myself that my personal life was personal and that it was nobody's business but my own. But that was the first time I started to consider that maybe the second wave feminist movement had a point when they said the personal is political, and that we needed to have a more open conversation about what is consensual and what is not consensual. Because when these lines are so blurred, it's easy to bury legitimate abuse just because it's easier to do so than to confront it.
Mm. I'm interested in the way that your feminism more broadly fits in with your fetish. You have a little riff about here and there about how you are not like one of the more submissive submissives. Mm-hmm. You know, what's the phrase that you used? It's help me out here.
The term that the BDSM community uses is that I'm a brat.
A brat, yes. That is not a technical term. I mean, it is in this community, but I should have been able to remember that. Anyway, tell me about what it's like to choose to be submissive, and how, you know, do you feel like you need to rationalize that with your feminism, or it's just choice feminism?
Well, I would say first that being submissive is never something that I choose. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's something that comes out in certain contexts or with certain partners. So as I write in the book, I'm a masochist and a bottom, and in some rare cases, a submissive. And these are all slightly different things, and they vary by circumstance. But to say how this relates to my feminism, a little bit of it is perhaps a branch of choice feminism, because I do feel the need to constantly overemphasize that none of this was a choice. There was certainly no point in my life when I chose to be this way, and in fact, for many decades, up to and including this year, there have been moments where if there's a magic pill I could take to just make this go away, to just be sexually normative, I would, because goodness knows I would have been able to skip over a lot of headaches and worse if I didn't have this fetish. So it's not a choice, mm-hmm. but I reconcile my identity with my feminism. I think that it is dangerous to suggest that anything innate could preclude someone from an ideology. Mm-hmm. I can believe in equal rights and opportunities and responsibilities for both genders and still be myself and express my, as I said again, innate, unchosen, and lifelong identity in a way that is healthy and satisfying for me while still believing in women's empowerment. But this is something that we talk about in the community. Our capital M, small f dynamics reinforcing problematic gender roles and relationships? Are they merely reflecting them? Is it something else entirely? Are capital F, small m relationships dismantling problematic gender relationships? You know, different people have different opinions, and this is tricky. So if we wanted to talk about this for 10 hours, we could.
Jillian, I got to say, you are an amazing spokesperson. I mean, even if you say you'd wish it away, it kind of needs you. You're so thoughtful and so good at explaining how this interweaves with your own personal history, with the culture, with literature. So that's great. It was really interesting to talk to you.
Thanks, Hannah. You just made me smile.
Good. So listeners, that's Sex with Shakespeare, a new book by Jillian Keenan, and it is out in only a few days. So look for it and buy it. Let's move on to our recommendations, but before we do those, let's hear from our final sponsor.
The Double X Gap Fest is also sponsored by Boll & Branch. So basically every study that comes out about health says the number one easiest thing you can do to improve your general health, well-being, and happiness is to get more sleep, which sounds easy, but it's actually not that easy. There are all kinds of bad habits we all have before bed. Some people watch TV. You know, I don't go on my computer anymore, but I sit in bed and scroll on my phone instead of reading.
The worst.
So bad. So bad. But there are a few things you can do to sort of calm your environment. You can, first of all, put away your phone. You can, maybe spritz some lavender-scented essential oil. You can really go to town. But the easiest thing to do is to get some beautiful, comfortable calming sheets. And luckily for all of us, Boll & Branch makes just those sheets. So what Boll & Branch has done is they've cut out the middleman and markups and the chain store mentality, and they deliver luxury sheets for a fraction of what you'd pay elsewhere. You can only get their sheets in one place. That's bollandbranch.com, where you know you're paying for quality and not department store overhead. You're getting $1,000 sheets for just a couple of $100, which is kind of a great deal. So go online to Boll, that's B-O-L-L, and branch.com, and they'll let you try them risk-free for 30 nights. If you don't absolutely love them, you can send them back. You literally have nothing to lose. And it gets even better, because you can go to bollandbranch.com today for 20% off your entire order. Not only do they have sheets now, they also have towels, blankets, duvet covers, the whole shebang, a whole linen closet. Plus, you get free shipping, and all their products come beautifully packaged in their signature boxes, which I've seen, and they really genuinely are beautiful. If you're looking for a good gift for someone, this seems like a lovely one. Go to bollandbranch.com today for 20% off your entire order and use the promo code double X. That's bollandbranch.com. Promo code is double X.
Okay, let's move on to our recommendations. June, what do you have for us this week?
I'm glad to go first because I'm guessing that all of you might have this thing teed up to recommend, but the new season of The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, which was made available on Netflix last Friday, is so good. It's better than the first season, I think, and I love the first season, and I think it was just really successful. It has the what could be perceived as the cynicism of the Tina Fey worldview, but because Kimmy Schmidt is so positive, and we see in the second season really trying very hard to be positive because there has been a lot of really serious shit in her life, that it just makes the joy even greater. So The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt on Netflix season 2 is just a thing of beauty and huge laughs.
That is so not what I was going to recommend. I am so into something so completely different. Actually, not that completely different because it's really funny. The new WNYC podcast, Two Dope Queens, it is like so good and so funny. It's by these two comedians, Phoebe Robinson and Jessica Williams, and it creates this alternative universe, kind of, where the two of them control the stand-up space and invite their friends to tell the funniest stories, and they are hilarious. And I don't think I've ever enjoyed a podcast more than I'm enjoying this one. It's so funny that I thought, like, I can't, the three of us got nothing, me and you guys. Like, we just will never be as funny as these two people ever. And so why should I come to work in the morning? Anyway, it's just so good. All right, Noreen, what do you got?
I have watched and been fascinated by a few episodes of The Girlfriend Experience, which is a Steven Soderbergh-produced TV take on the movie by the same name of a few years ago. And it stars Elvis Presley's granddaughter, which once you know that fact, you like can't look at her eyes in the same way. You're like, they're Elvis's eyes. But it stars Elvis.
We should say her name.
Oh, yeah. Riley Keough.
Elvis's granddaughter.
And she is a law student, apparently a very accomplished law student, who sort of decides to become a high-end prostitute after she sees her friend doing it and paying her rent. And the reason I'm interested in it and I bring it up here, I mean, I haven't watched the full season. Critics have raved about it. I was engrossed by the shows. They've got, you know, it's like a weirdly emotionally neutral palette and color palette, and she's a very her aspect is that of kind of a cold fish. Mm-hmm. But I'm interested in it because I think it's sort of like a commentary on hookup culture in a weird way. The one of the early episodes shows her having a very, very transactional bar hookup. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like the director or producer showrunner is making some kind of argument that, like, almost there's an extension from doing that to doing it for money with older men. And I just found the like commentary on millennial hookup culture as related to, you know, the sex trade kind of fascinating. So check it out and tell me all the ways in which I'm wrong or right.
And no one
whatever.
Was offended by that description in any way. All right. Sounds great. So thank you to our fabulous producer, Anne Hepperman. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lichtai. Andy Bowers, the chief content officer of the Panoply Network, and our intern is Shiva Bayat. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Our show page to find out more about the show, slate.com/XX. Facebook page is facebook.com/XXGabFest. You can email us at XXGabFest@slate.com or subscribe on iTunes or any place where you get your podcast. Please tell us again, sorority girls or mothers of sorority girls, what you know about your experience in a sorority. We would love to hear from you either on Facebook or by email. Thank you. And for Noreen and June, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will see you in a couple of weeks.
You're not supposed to do that. You know you're not allowed to. If you seem to get some kind of kick, I'm doing what you're not allowed to. You deliberately defy the rules, 'cause the laws are held by